the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
That's great. I'd like to look at just a couple of verses in addition to what we've looked at already. They're very short, so if you don't want to look at them, don't worry, in the Bible in front of you. But if you do, the first one's page 586, Psalm 111. And it says some very similar things to Isaiah. Praise the Lord. I will exalt the Lord with my whole heart in the council of the upright and in the assembly. Great are the works of the Lord. They are pondered by all who delight in them. Or they are researched by all who delight in them. They are sought out, as I think the Authorized Version puts it, by all who delight in them. Then there's in the New Testament, 1 Peter chapter 3, and that's page 1153. This is a letter that's written to some people whom Peter knows are going to be experiencing persecution very soon. And he feels it's really important that they approach it with the right attitude. And so he says in verse 13, just keep going. Who's going to harm you if you're eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you're blessed. Do not fear their threats. Do not be frightened, but in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. Always be ready with a reason. Well, we're starting a new series this morning about three things that you could say to answer various questions. Why are we doing that? This is a guy who used to come and preach at Belmont. I'm not sure he's ever going to come again because he's now retired. I'm not sure what he's doing. But he is a man called Derek Stringer, who was one of the most organized preachers we ever had. He never had less than about 150 PowerPoint slides. He went through them at great speed, telling some of the worst jokes in the history of the human race in the process. And he was always so cut and dried, it wasn't true. I remember when I was about 20-something, just listening to him open-mouthed one night in the church I used to belong to in Swindon, in Wiltshire. And with us that night was Peter Maiden, who went on to become coordinator of Operation Mobilisation. And he's got a lot more bravery than I have. So he went to Derek at the end and said, "How is it that when you speak, it just sounds like you're turning on a tap? It just comes out. Effortlessly, it just flows out." And Derek said, "Well, I'll tell you." He said, "I always memorize the first three sentences of any talk I give." Because he said, "I reckon that when you pass your first three sentences, you're in the flow. You're going. You can't stop. You might be on your own after that point, but at least you've started." I think that's absolutely right. I don't do that very often, but I must admit, when I'm in a high-pressure situation, I will often memorize the first words I'm going to say at a funeral or a wedding or something like that, because occasions like that, you get it wrong, they remember it for the rest of their lives, except in the case of the person who's died. But, you get one chance to do it right. And so in a situation like that, I'm always sure to be prepared. Now, I think that we are liable over the next few weeks and months to have a lot of people asking us why we believe what we do. I hope so anyway, because that's the whole point of doing the survey that we're doing, the Yesterday's Hero survey, which is supposed to provoke all kinds of conversations with all kinds of people that we know and possibly people we don't know as well. And they're going to be asking questions. Now, there is nothing to be worried about that in that at all. Paul Little, a man who used to work among students in Eastern Europe for many years, once reckoned that there are eight basic questions that non-Christians act. Because people's minds are actually very boring, very predictable. And if you want to find what his eight are, it's in a book called How to Give Away Your Faith, which is still in print today, written in the 60s, still in print, because it's a very useful book. I wouldn't quite honestly, though, because I think it's much more useful to work out what the eight are in your culture, in your context, among your friends. But something like that is true. And I've often found I've been on a school mission or a university mission somewhere and somebody said, I've got a great objection to what you've been saying. I spent all last night thinking this one out. You'd better sit down before I hit you with this one. So you sit down and say, okay, come on, tell me. And so he comes up with this great objection. You think, yes, number three. And it can be, quite honestly, that predictable. And so you don't need to know much. But you do need to know answers to some of the basic things. So this series is going to try to help you just to do a little bit of that. And what we're going to give you are three answers on each subject, because I reckon that's all you can hold in your head at any one time. I say that on the basis of painful years of experience of grocery shopping without a list. If you can hold three things in your head, that's as far as it's going to go. And so if you've got three things to start with, that's good. You'll probably find, actually I find in most conversations, you will only need one or two of them, because it starts them off talking about something else, or it answers the question that was being asked, or something like that. But it's a start. And of course, you may reach the point where, for instance, with this morning's question about science and God, you find you're dealing with one of the world's great research scientists, and you just don't have answers to the kind of questions he's giving. Well, always know where you can go next. And be honest, too. Don't flannel. Don't try to provide answers that don't really exist from information you don't really have. Just be honest. I don't know. You don't score any points for being an Encyclopedia Britannica. You score lots of points for honesty. But then say, but I'll find out. And then go off and find out from somebody else. Now, we have a church here that's full of scientists. And one of the silly things is that I'm standing here doing this. Well, maybe it's not so silly, as I'll tell you in a moment. But I'm not a scientist, so don't come to me with any complicated questions. Go to Simon Richards. Go to Sas Flynn. Go to lots of the people that are around here who genuinely are scientists. And if you don't know who they are, then ask some questions, because that's good in growing the fellowship and finding out who's who. I'm not going to tell you, but find them, because we have got people here who have answers to all the questions you'll be asked. So you needn't be scared of anything, but you do need something at least to make it clear that you've at least thought through the basics of something like this. So we're going to give you one or two answers this morning. One more thing to say before I start. I mentioned I am not a scientist. I gave up science at O-level. But don't ask me about my O-level results. I hated the smell of science labs. I fell out of love with science permanently when one little lad in my first year group managed to, around about November the 5th, get hold of some bangers and heat them up in the test tube just to see what would happen. And having watched his eyebrows being burned off, I thought, science is dangerous. I'm going to read books instead. And so I went for the rather safer arts. And so I'm not a scientist by any stretch of the imagination, and usually if I'm giving a talk here and I'm putting any sort of scientific reference into it whatsoever, you can see Christine Hughes sitting in the back row going, oh no, no, oh no. So don't trust on me as an expert. So I was thinking, why should I be doing this talk? And I just spent the last couple of days repainting our bedroom. And if you wonder why it took 2 days, that's because the wall above our bed is shot through with holes from all sorts of things, plugs sticking out the wall. It's had shelves put on it, lights put on it. It's had this great sort of tower arrangement around it, wardrobes and stuff like that. And the wall is pretty awful. It looked like a Swiss cheese when I started, in several colours. And I don't want to worry my wife, but I think the wall that she's now sleeping in front of is about one-third masonry and two-thirds polyvilla. But not to worry. I had to work out how to sand the wall down, because I'm not very good at that sort of thing. And I found when I went onto the internet, the experts weren't a lot of use, because they know it all. And they want to sell you flashy equipment. And they want you to sign up to their email site. I found much more help from idiots like myself, who have forums where they say, duh, how exactly do you hammer a nail into a wall? You know, and ask the really stupid questions. In fact, there used to be a do-it-yourself hire place, is what I'm looking for, just up the road here. It's gone, long gone since now. But they used to have a great notice above the counter which said, ask the stupid question. That's because they've got guys coming in to hire, angle grinders, power drills, all kinds of things that could take people's heads off with it if you didn't know what you were doing. And they'd say, now you have used one of these, oh, sure, many, many times, yeah. And you're all right with it, yeah, no problem at all, yes. Oh, it's one of those, I usually use the bigger model, but never mind, that'll do. And people put on this macho act, and then they go out and think, where's the on button? And it's crazy, because sometimes it's only when you ask the simple questions, the silly things, that you actually find out what you really need to know. So maybe you're better in the hands of a non-scientist this morning, because at least I can't complicate you with words that I don't understand. So three things I would say if I was asked this question. Hasn't science disproved everything? And I want you to remember just three phrases this morning. Six words. I hope you can do that. Number one, different questions. Number two, believing experts. Number three, new evidence. And if you can keep that in your brain, I think you have got three good answers you can use when you're asked that question. You see, it's a big one in our society, isn't it? I remember a couple of years ago being in Israel on a school trip, and we went on the last day to Masada, that great fortress that Herod built out in the desert, and they have a massive gift shop. And some of the students we took with us had obviously been very, I don't know, impressed emotionally by the trip. They'd had to think about the story of Jesus again. And I came across a girl called Jess, a sixth former, in the gift shop, buying a cross. And she said, "Sir, which one do you think I should have to put around my neck?" I said, "Jess, you can't wear a cross around your neck. You're not a Christian." She said, "Yeah, I know, but I kind of like to be." And then she said, "The trouble is, I'm too scientific." And her friend, who'd come up by this point, said, "Yeah, it's a lovely story, but you just can't believe it, can you?" Well, when I got back home, I mentioned this to Jess's biology teacher. And when I said, "She says she's too scientific," he coughed and spluttered. "If that girl passes AS level, she'll be doing really well." But she wasn't a scientist, but she just felt that science had excluded the whole question of God, wiped the floor with Christianity, and now the only people who believed it were people who were credulous and stupid. Okay, these six words, I think, give us some different answers. First of all, different questions. What do I mean by that? Well, science and religion are both talking about the world, but they do it in different ways. They're asking different questions. Science is asking the question, how? How did it all come together? How was it made? What are the mechanisms that lie behind it? Religion, on the other hand, is asking, why? Why did it happen? Why am I here? Okay, I know from science I'm a product of my DNA. I know from science that biologically I'm a member of the human species, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't give me any clue about what I'm living for. Stephen Jay Gould, one of the world's great biologists until he died in 2002, talked about science and faith as non-overlapping magisteria. And that's become such a famous phrase. People talk about NOMA now. What does he mean by non-overlapping magisteria? Well, what's a magisterium to start with? A magisterium, he said, is a domain where one form of teaching holds the appropriate tools for meaningful discourse and resolution. In other words, he's saying science is a magisterium, but religion is a magisterium as well. They're both working with different tools, asking different questions. And if they seem into conflict, come into conflict, they're not, because they're non-overlapping. Well, that's a position that's been criticised by a lot of people, including Richard Dawkins, but it's a position which makes an awful lot of sense. He said this: science tries to document the factual character of the natural world and develop theories that coordinate and explain these facts. Religion, on the other hand, operates in the equally important but utterly different realm of human purposes, meanings, and values, subjects that the factual domain of science might illuminate but can never resolve. And so he says, if science thinks it can invade religion's realm and knock things about a bit, it can't. If religion can no longer dictate the nature of factual conclusions regarding residing properly within the magisterium of science, then scientists cannot claim higher insight into moral truth from any superior knowledge of the world's empirical constitution. Now, science and religion have to talk to one another, but they can't answer one another's questions. And so for a scientist to say, "You're just a piece of matter," that's it. The Earth is just a tiny planet on the edge of space, and that's it. It's what used to be called ontological reductionism. Or Donald Mackay, the great Christian scientist, had a great phrase for that. He said, basically, it's nothing buttery. Man is nothing but a speck of dust. History is nothing but a series of random accidents. You can't say that. You're working outside your magisterium. And Erwin Schrödinger, the great early 20th century scientist, said that I'm very astonished that the scientific picture of the real world around you is very deficient. It gives a lot of factual information, puts all our experiences in a magnificently consistent order, but is ghastly silent about all and sundry that is really near to our heart, that really matters to us. It cannot tell us a word about red and blue, bitter and sweet, physical pain and physical delight. So there are limits to science. And so he went on to say this: science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains. That's the domain of religion, of spirituality, of philosophy, of other things like that. But the answers are very often so silly that we are not inclined to take them seriously. And that, I think, is why Richard Dawkins' star is on the wane at the moment. Because after 10 years of looking at his books, and catching a little bit of his excitement about what science can teach us. People are now starting to say, but that's it? That's all there is? And it's a chilling picture when you look at it. Here is a very famous picture. It's an image of Earth taken by Voyager 1, spacecraft that was sent up in 1990 to take pictures. And just as it reached the edge of the solar system, they turned it around to make it take a picture back to see what it saw. No, it's not the edge of the solar system, it's further than that. 4 billion miles away from Earth, anyhow. And there's a little blue dot in the middle of that stream of light, and as it says, you are here. Carl Sagan, atheist scientist, wrote a book called The Pale Blue Dot about the significance of life on Earth. He said, this is where it's all happened. All the loves, all the hates, all the wars, all the battles, all the empires, everything has happened on that pale blue dot. And it means pretty much nothing. Because of the reflection of sunlight, Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light in that picture, as if there were some special significance to this small world. But it's just an accident, he says, of geometry and optics. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. And so Sagan's message in that book is this is it, folks. We're the only thing here. We're the only thing around through the vast echoing spaces. If we blow it, if we explode enough bombs, we disappear too, and then the universe has no meaning left in it whatsoever because we create our own meaning. That's a terrible thought, isn't it? That we're all there is. That your life will end someday and that will be the end of all of your significance. And everything you've thought about every moment of the day in your waking life about relationships, about aims and dreams and ambitions, it'll all just disappear and be rolled up like that. If that's all that science has to say, well, maybe you need that other magisterium. You see, science and religion are talking about many of the same things and agreeing on several things. It's no surprise that Christianity was the soil from which science sprung. It's in the Christian West that you find science developing, not in the world of Eastern religions. Why? Because of three convictions, at least, that Westerners have got, thanks to Christianity, that aren't necessarily true in the rest of the world. First, the universe is good, and it's good to know about it. It's reliable. You can trust it. It's orderly and rational. And so what happens, you can expect to happen in the same way. If you do a scientific experiment, mix these two chemicals in a test tube, and what happens? Yes, it turns brown. It'll do that every single time. If one day you mix up those two chemicals and shake it about a bit, and it explodes and burns your eyebrows off, then you've got a problem. Because science is supposed to be repeatable, orderly, rational. And the third thing that Christians and scientists agree about is that human sense perception and reason are basically reliable. You can do experiments in the real world and get real information back from it. This world is not just some sort of dream that's changing every 5 minutes. It's a reliable, orderly place in which to be. And then science goes on to ask the how questions, and religion goes on to ask the why questions. And so that means sometimes they're using different language, doesn't it? Suppose you're standing here at Belmont and somebody asks you, how far is it to the cathedral? You probably say, oh, about half a mile. Suppose somebody else said, no, I've been looking at Google Maps and actually it's 0.6 of a mile. And somebody even more objectionable comes along, well, actually, I've spent the last 3 days measuring it with my little tape measure and it's 0.678956 of a mile. You'd think, get a life. I mean, for all intents and purposes, that first estimate is okay, isn't it? Just about half a mile. That tells you how long it'll take to walk there. That's fine, no problem. And sometimes you'll find that in the Bible, you are not being given precise scientific data. It's talking about things the way they appear. You see, a scientific description isn't everything. You could look at this sign. You could make a full scientific description of it in terms of the metal of the signpost and the metal of the top there. You could describe the qualities of the paint and the different molecules you'll find in the red paint and the yellow paint and all the rest of it. But unless you read what it actually says, caution, minefield, that scientific description isn't going to get you very far. And so there are different levels of meaning for things. And science explores one level of meaning. Christianity is exploring a completely different one. And Christians, great Christians down through the ages have recognized this. It's often thought by atheists that everybody believed in the Bible story in the most literal way possible until now, and suddenly science has exploded on. Not at all. You look back at some of the greatest Christians in history. You find St. Augustine, saying that the story of creation in Genesis 1 is not as it appears. Now, we've probably got people here who believe in the literal truth of Genesis 1 and 2, and we've probably got people here too, well, I know we have, who don't accept that, and I'm not going to get into that debate this morning. All I want to say is that from the start, Christians have recognized that you need to interpret the story in some kind of way. St. Augustine said he didn't think it was literal. God created everything in an instant. It didn't take him 6 days, or almost a week. And he described it for us as being completed in 6 days. So the 6 days is a pictorial description, said St. Augustine. And when it says that God planted a garden in Eden, that's obviously a picture too. God doesn't have to get down on his knees and fiddle with the dirt and plant things. That's not the way it is. It's just a way of describing it that makes sense to human beings. John Wesley in the 18th century, the inspired penman describes things by their outward sensible appearances and leaves us by further discoveries of the divine light to be led into the understanding of the mysteries couched under them. And when you get onto John Calvin, well, I won't even go into this one because it'll take me too long, but Calvin looks at chapter 1 of Genesis in his commentary and says, it could not have been that way. We know that the moon is not a lesser light to the sun. We know that scientifically that's not the way it is. And Calvin warned his followers, don't try to teach astronomy from Genesis, because that's not what it's for. So science and Christianity don't have to conflict. They're asking different questions. This is the motto of the Royal Society, perhaps the premier society, scientific society in the world still. And the motto of it is Nullius in Verba. Don't take anything for granted. Who founded the Royal Society? You look at the original people responsible for its foundation. Most of them were armchair scientists, people who spent their evenings and their weekends working on scientific projects and felt they all needed to come together in a society so they could pool the resources. They were also Protestant clergymen. And they believed Psalm 111, the works of the Lord are fantastic, sought out, researched by those who take delight in them. And so the Royal Society began with a bunch of Christians. That takes us on to the second thing, believing experts. You can make the point that science and religion are asking different questions. You can also point to people who have been scientists and Christians at the same time. Galileo, the glory and greatness of Almighty God are marvelously discerned in his works and divinely read in the open book of heaven. Johannes Kepler, O God, I am thinking thy thoughts after thee. And it's not just scientists from a long time ago. The doors of the Rutherford Laboratory in Cambridge have got those words that we've read from Psalm 111 inscribed above the doors. Why? The work of the Lord is great and sought out by those who take delight in them. Why? Because the laboratory was built by James Clerk Maxwell, one of the greatest scientists of all time, and a Scotsman, and also an evangelical Christian. And when the extension, the new Rutherford Laboratory, was built earlier on this century, the same text was repeated above the doors. Why? Because there was a research scientist there, just a doctoral student, who is now a professor, who made that suggestion to his professor. He said, oh, yeah, all right, I'll put it to the committee and see what happens. They put the words up there again. The research student, who's now an eminent professor, was a Christian. There are Christians who are believing scientists all over the place. We won't talk about Darwin, because we won't get into that one. But you might say, well, this is all people from the 19th century, even further back. Have we got believing scientists? Yes, we have. We've got John Polkinghorne, the greatest physicist Britain's produced in the last few years. We've got Francis Collins, who headed up the most expensive and extensive scientific project in the history of the world, the Human Genome Project. And we've got people like John Lennox, who used to come here because his daughter was at university, used to come to Belmont, sensible girl. And he's a mathematician, he's a Christian, he's debated Richard Dawkins and most of the other guys, Christopher Hitchens and all the rest of them, and emerged not unsuccessful. So we have got believing experts. I think it's fair enough to say to people who are asking, but hasn't science disproved God? Well, a lot of scientists who know a lot more than I do don't think so. You can't hide behind experts, obviously you can. But you can point to the fact that it's not just the loudmouths in the scientific world who say, no God, no purpose, no humanity. There are also loads and loads of believing Christians who are pretty eminent in their profession and still believe it. So there are four words so far. Do you remember what the four words were? The first two were different questions. The second two were Believing experts, great, that's fantastic. It's a hot day, got to keep you awake. Anyway, this is the most liturgical service I can remember in Belmont history. You had so many things to answer back to and bits to say and things like that. It's crazy. But anyhow, we're turning Anglo-Catholic. No. Anyway, new evidence. Let's look at that one to finish with. And all I want to say on this one is that cutting edge, frontier science is throwing up questions which don't fit with an atheist perspective. This is Paul Davies. He was a professor at Newcastle on Tyne. I think he's been to Australia since, and now he's in Arizona somewhere. But some of his books, like God and the New Physics, are really fascinating. And he says things like this: scientists are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves. For 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have been quietly collecting examples of all too convenient coincidences and special features in the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life, and hence conscious beings, to exist. Change any one of them and the consequences would be lethal. Fred Hoyle, the distinguished cosmologist, once said it was as if a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. Now, sadly, Davis never became a Christian. He came very close to it at one point, and now he's kind of dwindled away into a position where he believes that the universe somehow created itself. No idea how that can happen, and nor is he. But I think he's just had so many colleagues say, you can't believe in the ancient sky god, can you? You don't believe there's an old man with a beard up there? No. And so he's retreated, sadly, from his position. But the evidence still stands. And his books still show how many questions there are to answer. Fred Hoyle, the guy he mentions there, was somebody who definitely wasn't a Christian. He was famous in Britain as a taunter of Christians through the 50s and the 60s while I was growing up. And yet, I heard a radio interview with him just before he died, when he was saying, you know, my researches have led me to the conclusion that there is something funny going on in this universe. That it's as if there was almost a planning mind behind it. And the interviewer asked the obvious question, so does that mean, Professor Hoyle, that you now believe in God? And it was one of the funniest moments on Radio 4 I've ever heard. And on my car radio, I could hear him go, God, I mean, when you put it like that, God, I believe it, God. And he was trying not to use the word God, and he was failing miserably. Because the implication of all of his science was pointing back to the fact that we are in a designed universe made by somebody who has a plan for our lives. And sadly, I don't think Hoyle ever got to that point by the end of his life. Unlike others, it could be mentioned if we had time. But he was somebody whose research itself was pointing in that direction. Why? Well, I've shown you this slide before. I won't do it again. Let's just say this. I was going to show you a video too, which we've no time for, but let me just mention what it says. This is one frame from it. It's made by Eric Metaxas of Prager University in America, and Metaxas points out that the chance of life emerging on Earth is the same chance as if you flipped a coin that many times in a row, 10,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, very likely scenario. And so science itself is pushing us back in the direction of big questions. So let's just look at what we said, because we don't want to complicate this. Go away, Eric. I don't want your video. Thank you. That was it. Three questions, three statements, different questions, believing experts, new evidence. Isn't much, but it'll get you started. Let's pray. Father, you've told us always to be ready with a reason for the hope that's in us. And we thank you that those reasons abound in your universe. And despite the dominance of scientism in our society, the belief that says science explains it all, nonetheless, there are questions hanging out. Your glory will not be concealed, and the works of the Lord are wonderful, pondered by those who take delight in them. Help us to show people, when we get the chance in conversation, in just a few simple words, that the door is not closed to God just because of science. And if that leads on to another conversation that gives us a chance to talk about Jesus, that'll be fantastic.